The example I use of the difficulties that children face today from overparenting is the 180-degree turnabout in the game of pass the parcel.
Yes.
In my days, one child won pass the parcel. Now every child wins a prize.
Yes, that's right.
And whoever's birth that is gets the major prize at the end of the day, and I'm not sure that's teaching the appropriate lessons.
Couldn't agree more.
Your feeling about 6 months out about the change of government, something I probably would have concurred with in terms of the climate. A number of the factors that affect people's moods are outside the control of government. What sort of effect do you feel that the period of the coalition had in setting that mood, that dreamy period? Was that something that they stumbled into themselves, or was it partly by design?
I assume it wasn't by design. Of course, I don't know. When John Howard said, I think in 1996, the times will suit me, he was prophetic. I mean, the times absolutely suited him. And then quite suddenly, the times didn't suit him. And it seemed to me that he became a figure stranded by the turning of the tide. I noticed that a number of coalition members or people advocating coalition's position are describing this election outcome as an example of the mere need for change, like just it's time. You know, people talking about the it's time factor as though, well, we needed to change our hairstyle or put on a clean shirt. We needed to change of government, just freshen them up a bit. I don't think that explains such an emphatic landslide. I think you can't say, oh, people just wanted to change and then see what happened. The signs and the polls, it wasn't just my own research. I mean, News Poll, Nielsen, everyone was saying the same thing for months and months out from the election. And my interpretation of that, which not everyone agrees with, and I'm happy to debate it, but my interpretation was that many of the things that had passed us by while we were in the dreamy period came back into focus for us. And so, in a sense, this government found itself stuck with a whole lot of baggage that it didn't realise it had, baggage in the public mind, things that had not caused an outcry. I mean, going back to Aboriginal reconciliation and a lot of things, Iraq, AWB, work choices, all these sort of things, it was as though people were saying, actually, hang on, we're not really happy about all that. And although we sort of dozed through it at the time, even asylum seekers, you know, it wasn't a big... No one mentioned asylum seekers in the election campaign, but it was in the community's head as an issue that we allowed to go to sleep. So I think that's really the explanation. I think it was a particular kind of leadership was very appropriate for us during that period of restoration and recovery and retreat. And then as we emerged from it, that was no longer appropriate. And people did... I mean... When Bill Clinton said it's the economy, stupid, of course he was mostly right, and it's always the economy. Of course it's always the economy. This time round, it seemed to me the voters were saying, sure, it's the economy, but the economy is okay, and what about society? What about some of the values? What about national integrity? All these sort of quite visionary things that really people hadn't been talking about for a long time, they were talking about. And I thought that was all really the tolling bell for the government.
Can I just make a comment and a question in a way? One of the advantages of being a newbie is that all the stuff you read 40 years ago, I just read in the last 2 years.
Yes.
And so I remember reading Manning Clark's History of Australia, and as I read through there, I was thinking, you know, this election. And I thought about this before the election, that you know, everybody was talking about, is it like the election of 96 or 98 or 2001 or 2004? But it seemed to me, reading the history of Australia recently, that it was really like the election of 49, where you had Shifley, who had a brilliant record as a in the economy, and he had a good record, outstanding record in foreign affairs. And yet he had this little problem in the economy called trying to nationalize the banks. Mm-hmm. And then this guy Menzies came along, and all he wanted to talk about was the future. Mm-hmm. And so you had, you know, this time you had Howard wanting to run on his record, like Shifley wanted to run on his record. Like Shifley, he had a little nick called, work choices.
Yes.
And you had another guy coming along named Rudd who wanted to talk about the future. Mm-hmm. And in both 49 and 2007, the future trumped the record. Mm. Is there any validity to that, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that of that comparison, but I think when you make it, there's a lot of truth in it. Mm.
Wait till we get a microphone.
If you're right about the Great Awakening, this change of mood that's come upon us, what kind of practical implications do you think that has for the next for the incoming government? Because obviously it's coming into a very different ballgame.
I think whoever won this election was going to have a very rocky ride. I think if I'm right, and the signs suggest this, a much more engaged electorate is going to give the new government a much tougher time. I'm not sure. I mean, I agree with Phil's. I think it's a very interesting comparison with 49. I'm not sure that even Rudd and some of his front bench fully understand yet the extent to which the national mood has changed. I think they may not yet have fully... The fact that people were so appalled by Rudd's victory speech was an indication that their expectations may be greater than what's going to be delivered, that they are looking for future, they're looking for vision, they're looking for something that'll uplift us after a time when we feel as though it was all we're a bit numbed, it was all a bit dark. So whether they can deliver that remains to be seen, but I think they're going to have a much more difficult time than the Howard government has had over the last 7 or 8 years, because people are going to be much more active. The voices of activists, the voices of special interest groups, CEDA, everyone, I think is going to get a much better hearing in this community than has been the case. And so will politicians, but they will have to have something to say.
Hugh, I'm a child of the 60s, and when I was a child, our aspiration was to become an adult. But what I see today is that adults want to become children. So you typically hear parents talking about their best friend, who is their son or daughter. That kind of infantilism, I mean, how does that actually sit with this notion of an aspiration for greater vision and greater sophistication in our thinking that you've said is... coming out?
Is emerging. I mean, I'm not wanting to paint a picture of some sort of absolute sort of overnight transformation. I think we are emerging from the dreamy period, and that over the course of this government, we're going to see a much more engaged electorate. But it's a very interesting observation. We are seeing this curious... I mean, it used to be the case that children thought they had to please their parents. We now have a generation of parents who think their job is to try and please their children. And that's retarding the development of the parents and the children. You know, it's an odd cultural development. We're also seeing among people in their 20s, moving into their late 20s, it's now a cliche in that age group, 30 is the new 20. And what they're saying, I mean, this is partly a reflection of the increasing lifespan. We might better acknowledge that. But really what they're saying is, at 30... will be at about the point in the life cycle that our parents were when they were 20. In other words, adolescence is really being prolonged all the way through the 20s. For many people, not for everyone, of course, there are spectacular exceptions to everything I'm saying about generations. But it's all part of what you've identified, I think, as people wanting to be younger. I mean, the boomers, of course, currently aged 46 to 61, I think, they want to tell us they're the youngest generation in the history of the planet. You know, they're still wearing blue jeans at 60 to prove it. So that's an odd thing, that suddenly everyone wants to be young. I think as the boomers move into their 60s and 70s, it'll be a very different story. They'll want everyone to have a new respect for the old.
Chairman, we've captured the microphone and we're not giving it up at this table for these 5 minutes. But as you would know, I'm Phil Riven. I've been one of your longest admirers for a long time. Hugh, two things. One is a comment about divorce rate, because the highest divorce rate we ever saw was in 1976 when Murphy changed the law and then we had 76 or 77,000 divorces, which we've never beaten since as a number, which means if you look at the number of divorces as a proportion of the number of marriages in Australia, it's been falling like a stone for at least the last 31 years. So we haven't actually had an increase in the divorce rate now for over three decades, which is not to say it won't happen in the future. I think we're looking at more at the 2010s and beyond before we actually see an increase in the divorce rate for the first time in over three decades. So that's a minor correction, but that's got nothing to do with the strength of the
court. Yes, I shouldn't have given the impression that it had gone up. It went up and it stayed high, and it has, as a proportion of marriages,
fallen.
And in fact, I think just to extend the point, Phil, which I accept absolutely, if the marriage rate continues to fall, then inevitably, just as a statistical certainty, the divorce rate must also fall.
And that's why I think it's going to go up again in the 2010s.
Yes.
My real question, Hugh, if I may, is that I'm old enough to think there was a time when the big political fight was capitalism versus socialism, which I think died a long time ago. It's my argument that if there's a new political fight, it's humanism versus rationalism, and I think that's a worldwide phenomenon. That's in my opinion. Now, I think where Howard had been very clever from 1996 was that he's an absolute gene-programmed rationalist.
Yes.
But he had the cleverness to turn himself into a humanist 9 months before an election and then go back to his natural form.
Yes.
It just seemed to me that Howard, for the first time in all those elections, failed to become a humanist in that last year through old age or carelessness or ego or whatever, because he didn't give way on climate change, he didn't give way on work change, he didn't give way on saying sorry or whatever. And I think he just lost the ability to turn himself like a chameleon into a humanist. Anyway, that's now history. What I really am saying, therefore, is where does humanism, if I'm right, and rationalism fit into the lives of the future Australians?
Yeah, I thought I had the Riven philosophy straight. I haven't heard you on this particular one, but I like it. I mean, I think that analysis of the Howard years is very accurate and also helps to explain the appeal of Rudd, who portrayed himself. I mean, he had to fight to establish some rationalist credentials because he was seen so much the other way. I think we are, I mean, part of this emergence that we seem to be going through at the moment suggests to me that there's going to be much more, I'm not sure that I'd use the word humanist, but much more interest in the non-rational and the non-material. And maybe that's what you mean when you say humanist, which is not to say that capitalism will fade from people's thinking about the economy. I think we are all capitalists now, wherever we appear on the political spectrum. We've seen the full flowering of that in Australia and elsewhere. But I think part of this mood shift is a community saying there's more to life than that, that the materialist thing, the rampant materialism of the last 10 years leading us to record personal and household debt has caused, as it always does when people commit themselves to that in the absence of much else, it always leads to the questioning that, well, surely there's more to life than this. And you can see it in the rising generation. I mean, the late teens, early 20s, they're heavily into what they call spirituality, not necessarily religion, but they've grown up with a bit of a vacuum where all that non-materialist stuff was, and they're not turning their backs on it. They're, of course, they want top-of-the-range Nike, but they're saying, and there's more to life than top-of-the-range Nike. And I think, again, I think you're right in your analysis about the politics of it too. I think maybe Howard and his advisors totally missed that, but I think it's here to stay for some time. I think it is part of the emerging ethos. You can see it in the rise of interest. I mean, even in politics, an extraordinary thing in this last couple of years, or last year, really, where there's been much more discussion about politicians' religious faith than ever before. And that's that would have been quite unacceptable. Suddenly it's acceptable. Everyone's interested in how many Catholics there are on the coalition's front bench and, you know, is Rudd a Catholic or an Anglican? I mean, this is unheard of in recent Australian history. It's not so much about religion. It's about what are the values that these blokes stand for.
Ian Ferris, you, two things. Just following up that last point, is part of the reason that the swimming pool in your street and the new library in mine didn't, and the tax cuts didn't seem to echo with the politicians, with the public. Coming back to your point about coming out of the dream. Hmm. And secondly, your research over decades now, I'd be interested in the attitudes of both non-migrants and migrants to how they're treated today relative to earlier generations of to migration.
Yes, thanks, Ian. First of all, on your first point, yes, absolutely. I think, I mean, it seemed to me quite extraordinary that Labor just kept matching the coalition on things like tax cuts and the blizzard of multi-billion dollar promises, because that you can see what happened in the polls, namely nothing. I mean, that election campaign was, in my view, almost completely irrelevant to the outcome, because people had put their glasses down months beforehand. They'd decided what they were going to do, and it didn't really matter whether, you know, Peter Garrett made a mistake or Tony Abbott was late for the debate or whether the tax cuts were going to cut in now or in 5 years. You know, and when the pollies started debating whether you were going to be $14 a week better off in 2014, you know, not surprisingly, the community lost interest. And that was another symptom of the fact that this election in people's minds was about something else. Extraordinary the extent to which Labor's matching of the... I mean, the media, of course, went into paroxysms when Howard and Costello announced their tax cuts right at the beginning. You know, King hit, what will Rudd do now? And what the community, I think, was hoping was that Rudd would do nothing about that except say, well, we can think of a lot more things to do with the money than that, instead of which he matched it. But it was all irrelevant in the wash-up. And now, having got so excited about that, oh yes, yes, I think the attitude to immigrants has undergone, which obviously goes through many phases, and each new wave of immigrants always finds they're having a hard time because whether it's Sudanese or Vietnamese or Greeks and Italians, to go back to the 40s and 50s. What seems to have happened, though, is that in the last seven, during this period that I've been describing, it's actually got tougher in general for immigrants, not just for the latest wave, because I think this has been a period in which prejudices which we had learned and which in a civil society, I mean, we all have prejudices. In a civil society, we keep them on the leash. I think what we've seen in the last 10 years or so is an unleashing of prejudice. Hard to say exactly why, and I don't want to get into sort of political explanations of that now, but maybe there's a leadership issue here. I suspect there is. But certainly what I noticed in my own research around the turn of the century and in these years of the first decade of the new century was much more outspoken prejudice. People being quite prepared to attack immigrants, Aborigines, asylum, you know, refugees in general, in a way that seemed to me to have been under control. And I assume it'll get under control again, but at the moment it's not, you know, we don't seem to have had leadership of a kind that we had, for example, under Malcolm Fraser and under Bob Hawke, where particular immigrant groups, though they are strange to us, are to be welcomed. That seems not to have been part of our fabric. I assume that as part of this phenomenon that Phil was identifying also, we'll see this back under control. We'll recognise that our record here long term is brilliant, and this is a bit of an aberration. But it goes along with feelings of insecurity and loss of control. I mean, we don't have to be too tough on each other. It's fair to say that when people are feeling a bit anxious and insecure, they do shut down and cocoon. And one of the implications of that is that they do become hard line in various ways, and prejudice against otherness is one of those ways.
I wonder if you could say, in the society that we're going to, what role you see that ethics and spirituality, and you mentioned that just earlier, play in that society?
The
society that we're going to become, what role of ethics and spirituality has?
Yes, an increasing role. I mean, I think this election, in fact, I wrote in a piece, I think, in the Herald, this election was as much about moral leadership as about economic management. Now, I didn't say that lightly, and I wouldn't have said that of any election that I can recall writing about. But part of this, what Phil described as the move from rationalism to humanism, is to say, not we've turned our back on materialism, but to say we want to temper our materialism with greater moral sensitivity. Young people today approaching the job market, we hear this consistently on university campuses, are saying, I want to work for the kind of company I could believe in. I want to know what their values are. Now, this is almost unprecedented for young people in a job hunt, but that's a little signpost to something I think quite significant that's happening.
Table three, the microphone, where is it?
Yes.
Thank you, and that was a good lead-in to my question, because I wanted to look at that issue of Generation Y. You had mentioned that Generation Y basically are victims of overzealous parents.
No, it's the next generation down that I was describing as the victims,
the next generation
yes.
Down. Yes. Okay. All right. Well, I'm an overzealous parent. And I think a lot of people around this room are probably yes. overzealous parents. And yes. for example, my daughter's in first year at university and she had asked me to find a part-time job for her. So I put out feelers to various organisations and then found a job with a particular organisation that's very highly regarded, an investment bank. Ran up to her and said, this is fantastic. I've got you this job, a part-time job, and all you have to do is ring up tomorrow. And she said back to me, no, I don't want to work. And I won't say the company. I do not want to work with that company. Everybody knows that they pay you a shitload of money, but they take your life away. And I thought, that's really good that she thinks that way. I'm really pleased.
Yes.
Anyway, so I'm hoping that you'll say I'm not an overzealous parent. Yes. And that I have actually given her the right value.
Yes. Yes, that's right. I mean, I think you win and lose from that story. 10 out of 10 for values, 0 out of 10 for looking for a job for your 21-year-old daughter. Yes. Yeah.
One last question.
Hugh, one thing you haven't mentioned is the question of short-term versus long-term attitudes in the community. I mean, in the last 20 years, we've created the I suppose, ultimate short-term society, whether it's politically or corporately, with incentives and whatever. At the same time, what we're facing is really the major issues are all now very much long-term. How do you think the community is going to cope with the sort of, I think it's going to be more than renovation, but the rebuilding that's going to have to be done in trying to reconcile those things?
Yes. Yes, thanks for that. It's a terrific question to end on. My answer is they're going to cope extremely well. One of the things, let's look at what's happened in Brisbane. In the last 2 years, metropolitan Brisbane has cut its water consumption to one-third of what it was 2 years ago. Now, sure, there have been restrictions, but this is a very compliant population, not famous for being a compliant population. And Sydney's doing a similar thing, not quite as spectacular as Brisbane. Now, that's, to me, a little sign that the mood is changing on this point as well. And by the way, your comment about short-term thinking in politics and in business is echoed all around the community by people who you might think of as relatively lowly paid, relatively unsophisticated employees who make exactly this point and say things like, you know, the incentives that the boss gets mean that he's only focused on the share price this year. You know, he's going to be rewarded for getting the share price up. Well, what's that about? and the idea that that a government, I mean, 3-year terms for our federal government, you know, is very counterproductive. Obviously, we ought to be talking about having longer term longer terms for all our governments, but especially federal, for precisely this reason. But the challenge of global warming, climate change, renewable resources, the sustainable future, all of that stuff now looms as such a big issue in people's minds that already people are starting to say, well, what can we do? And they don't mean, they're not wringing their hands saying, oh, what can we do? They're saying, what can we do? We can recycle our newspapers. We've learned how to do that. But surely, you know, we can save water. But surely there are other things we could be doing. This is a community in the mood now, for the first time for a decade, to think big. And part of thinking big is think longer. And I think for people like those in this room, business leaders of Australia, as well as political leaders, the time to start talking in a visionary way and to lengthen the horizon is right now. And you'll be, I think you'll be very pleasantly surprised by the warmth of the reception you'll get.
Hugh, thank you. Thank you very much indeed for your wisdom and your insights. And thank you most of all for holding up a mirror so we can see ourselves more clearly.